From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. You're working hard, straining to balance the demands of job and family, and now the holidays to boot. Is this normal stress, or are you chronically stressed out? And is your body paying the price? We've known for decades that stress takes a toll on physical health, but a growing body of convincing research has emerged demonstrating how psychological stress in small doses can be beneficial, while deep, unending stress can sharply increase vulnerability to disease. How can we learn to maintain that perfect balance, to cover all the bases and be healthy? New insights into stress and its antidotes tonight. Do you have a healthy level of stress in your life, or something more? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now is Dr. Bruce McEwen, director of the Neuroendocrinology Lab at Rockefeller University and author of the new book, The End of Stress as We Know It. Good evening and welcome, Dr. McEwen.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for joining us. Dr. McEwen, I guess the place to start out is we all think we know what stress is or know it when we feel it, but what is stress in your mind? What is it?
Well, I think of stress as a specific experience or set of experiences that we have that threaten us in one way or the other, maybe not physically, but psychologically make us feel anxious and uneasy and causes physiologic responses in our bodies and in our brains, and the production of hormones, stress hormones such as cortisol and adrenaline, and the activity of different parts of our brains that are involved in helping us decide what is stressful or not. It's that physiologic response that I'm the most interested in and concerned about, because in the short run, the response helps keep us alive and functioning, but in the long run, if it's mismanaged, it can cause problems.
How widespread, in your view, in American society today is mismanaged stress?
Well, I think it's mismanaged in terms of how the body handles it. For example, I think that it's not just the stressful experiences, but these hormones that I'm referring to are also involved in responding to, for example, having a bad night's sleep, smoking a cigarette, taking a drink, the kind of food we eat, whether we exercise or not, things that we would I would call lifestyle. Mm-hmm. These have as much of an effect on these stress hormones as the experiences that are stressful. And one often reinforces the other. That is, you grab a bag of potato chips or some comfort food when you're feeling tension and feeling stressed, and this actually makes the physiologic response worse and can lead to this thing that I'm referring to as the mismanagement.
I guess as I read through your book, The End of Stress as We Know It, I was struck at how you're kind of putting stress at the center of all health issues, or of a great volume of health issues, and it's more than just the kind of uptight, nervous feeling we get in a traffic jam or when we're overloaded with work. It's an overall balance in life, or a lack of balance.
Yes, I think that's right. In fact, I think I want to emphasize is what we refer to as the stress hormones are also very much basic housekeeping hormones. They're involved in many other aspects of our physiology. As I said, when not having a good night's sleep for a number of nights will cause the cortisol levels to become elevated in the evening when they normally should be low. Now, you can call that stressful, but you can also talk about it as an unbalancing of a normal physiologic housekeeping function. So the stress hormones are more than just for stress.
You write in the book that prolonged or severe stress can lead to a weaker immune system, to constrain the heart, damage memory cells in the brain, and lead to greater fat deposits around the waist, which are risk factors for heart disease, cancer, other illnesses.
That's correct.
What is the process by which someone's saying, wow, I'm really stressed out, and inside their body, all of this deterioration is taking place? What's the connection? How does it work?
Well, I think the first thing to realize is that in small doses with an acute stressful experience, these same hormones that are going to that may cause you trouble over long periods of time are actually what's keeping you alive. They're helping actually to enhance immune function. They're helping you to remember places and situations which in the future you can remember. If you remember them, you can stay out of trouble. They're actually helping you mobilize energy when you need it to do a demanding task.
So I've got to give a speech or step on the brakes or get something done in a hurry.
These are the fight or flight response, which gets an animal or a person out of danger, chased by an antelope, chased by a lion, or somebody reacting to danger and trying to run away or use energy to get out of trouble. You're expending energy and you're using these same hormones to keep you functioning. So I wouldn't get rid of these hormones at all because they're helping to keep a person alive.
So but if they come when you need them,
they're
an advantage to have and have been for eons.
When you don't need them, that's the critical thing, and that's what I mean by mismanagement. And I come back again to the example of eating, say, a fat-rich meal, especially before you go to bed, not having a good night's sleep, not doing some form of regular exercise like walking or some form of physical exercise. These things can then push the body towards this mismanagement I'm talking about. But if you exercise, watch your diet, try to get a good night's sleep, don't eat too much in the evening, try to eat a good balanced diet, all the good stuff that our mothers and grandmothers tried to teach us, then this helps these physiologic systems it helps you manage these systems in a way that helps, minimize
more effectively
these problems.
Bruce McEwen, put that good advice that Grandma might have given all of us into a context in time. I mean, I think many people today have the sense that we live in extraordinarily fast-paced, demand-burdened times. Is stress an inevitable outcome of overcrowded lives, or are you saying all we have to do is live better and we can deal with the pace of contemporary life no problem?
Well, I think that's a critical question. I think speaking for myself, knowing these things, I have to try to make choices, and I don't necessarily always make the right choices because I lead a busy life too, and sometimes I don't do what I think I should. Perhaps I don't sleep as well. I may not eat the right things, or particularly may not get the amount of exercise I think I need. But I try to correct this if I possibly can. And so knowing the knowledge that I try to impart in this book gives a person then a series of choices that you have to make. It doesn't tell you how to make those choices because everybody has to face these choices in their own lives.
But bottom line, let's say I'm doing everything right. I'm exercising, I'm eating right, I'm sleeping as much as I should be sleeping, but I've just got a life that is so intensely packed with activities around work and family and children and all kinds of obligations. Is it not possible that that contemporary pace of life can overwhelm even the most finely balanced, lifestyle?
Probably so, but in a sense, all the things that you describe imply a sense of control and mastery that not always, but at least a sense that there is some purpose and some direction and some meaning with family and friends and social support networks and things like that, and interesting work perhaps to keep one involved. I mean, these are all positive aspects, and having lacking control over things or having a meaningless job or relationships that are troubling, those are the things that are probably pushing people in the direction that I'm talking about more than necessarily having a very active and satisfying life.
Bruce McEwen, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Dr. Saki Santarelli. Dr. Santarelli is director of the Stress Reduction Clinic at the University of Massachusetts Medical School and author of Heal Thyself, Lessons in Mindfulness in Medicine. Good evening and welcome, Saki Santarelli.
Thank you, Tom. Good evening.
Well, thanks for joining us. You hear us digging into stress tonight. A lot of people feel it. People talk about it all the time. I wonder what your sense is of how prevalent a dangerous level of stress is in American society today.
Well, I can say this, that when I began the work that I'm doing now at the Stress Reduction Clinic nearly 20 years ago, actually, I was an intern there in 1981, so a little bit more than 20 years ago before beginning to work there. I'd say that the level of stress that we had and were working with people with then in some cases was the same, certainly having to do with the stresses associated with illness and sickness and serious diagnosed conditions, as well as other kinds of stress that had more to do with the sickness of children, taking care of elderly parents, all of those things that push and pull on us in some way. But I would say now that our patients are saying more than I've ever heard before that the relentless demands of time are becoming much more overwhelming and much, much more difficult to manage, as Dr. McEwen said, or handle effectively.
And why would that be? I mean, human life has never been easy. People hundreds and thousands of years ago had to do a lot of physical tasks that we don't have to do just to keep themselves fed and alive.
Yeah.
So why would the body respond with more stress to the kinds of challenges we have today, a traffic jam, a car alarm?
I think it's less the traffic jam and car alarm as a singular event. I think it's the cumulative buildup of events that tends to create more stress and strain in people. For instance, when you think about it, 10 years ago, most of us didn't have a personal computer on our desk. The digital age was just coming into being in many ways. In the last decade, the digital age has become much more full-blown in our lives, and the amount of information that we're all being asked to keep up with, the amount of structure in our lives, for instance, with our children. Children have much more structured lives in terms of activities outside of the home than they did 10 or 15 or certainly 20 years ago. That parents are in many ways obliged to and want to support their children in, whether it's soccer or softball or basketball or football or the thousand other things that our children are engaged in, and that parents wind up having to really be largely the chaperone for their children and in most cases desiring to do that. On top of that, productivity in America keeps being touted as having gone up, and that's in many ways the way we have ameliorated some of the negative side effects of even the current recession. But that productivity is built on people's backs.
Bruce McEwen, do you agree that we're literally living a more crowded life today?
I agree completely. I think of cell phones and fax machines and computers, which were supposed to save us time to do other things, but have increased our own expectations and expectations of our bosses and as Dr. Santarelli says, of the whole society for being more productive. And so the pace is just getting faster and faster all the time.
So are we reaching the limits of what we can physically handle as Homo sapiens?
It's hard to know the answer. I think that essentially that's a very good question, Tom, and it winds up being, interestingly enough, largely an individual a quest rather than that we could answer it, I think, across the board for society in general, although we're certainly seeing across society in general. I think the latest estimates are 1 million lost work days per day in America due to stress or stress-related absenteeism or underproductivity. And the American Medical Association, which is a very conservative organization, estimates at this time that about 70 to 80% of all visits to a primary care doctor across the United States is stress-related.
We're going to come back and look at who suffers those health issues because of stress issues. Dr. Bruce McEwen puts it right at the center of an awful lot of health issues. Questions for you. Can you feel your body's response to stress? And what pins your meter? Is it shopping or work or traffic jams? Do you have a healthy level of stress in your life or something more? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about stress and human health. A little is good. A lot can kill you. My guests tonight are Dr. Bruce McEwen, who's director of the Neuroendocrinology Lab at Rockefeller University and author of the new book, The End of Stress, As We Know It, and Dr. Saki Santarelli, director of the Stress Reduction Clinic at the University of Massachusetts Medical School, author of Heal Thyself, Lessons in Mindfulness in Medicine. Bruce McEwen, take us into the profile of the most stress-vulnerable people. I was fascinated by what you found there. It's not just to do with the pace of our lives, but it's with what we bring to that pace and, in part, where we fall in society.
That's right. I think one simple fact is that I think it was in 1995, the death rate from chronic diseases for men who had less than 12 years of education, in other words, less than a high school education, mm-hmm. was 2.5 times the rate of more educated men. In other words, education, which also implies income, and also implies probably something about a whole life history starting early in childhood, can have a devastating effect on the average.
But how do you relate that to stress? Perhaps with less education, they had less income, less access to health care, less healthy lifestyle.
I think it's all of these, although studies in the British civil service, where everybody does have access to health care and has a job, have shown these same kind of gradients with people who have, at the lower employment grades, have higher rates of various diseases, have higher death rates, show on the average a higher waist-hip ratio, indicating abdominal fat, have higher rates of cardiovascular disease. So there are aspects that go beyond simply access to health care or who has a job. It's how you live your life.
And you say it's about social status, or at least about how we perceive our social status. Why would that figure into stress and stress-related health problems?
Well, I think, for one thing, striving a sense of where you are. There are studies that show that with greater degrees of income inequality, countries, for example, Sweden has a lower overall mortality rate than the United States. They have a shallower income gradient. There are smaller differences between the wealthiest and the poorest people and more social support systems. So it has to do with where you see yourself and how hard you're striving and how you react to not being on top, so to speak, or feeling where you are.
I'm fascinated by that piece of it. You say look back to the 50s and old television shows like I Love Lucy. You say look at the supremely ordinary apartment that Lucy and Ricky lived in. Look at Ethel's dowdy dresses. There was less pressure to climb way high up the income gradient than there is today, and with that, perhaps less stress.
And a greater sense of well-being, perhaps because one felt they were with most other people that they could identify with. And now we, of course, see the extreme people with extreme wealth, and the emphasis on earning a lot of money seems to have increased. And there seems also to be some threat to the social net that supports us, although Social Security certainly has done a wonderful job of protecting people, but people probably feel threatened about losing some of those benefits, and that can contribute to a level of anxiety and forms of behavior which are not good for one's health.
And then on the medical side, Saki Santarelli, I wanted to just ask about this. In the foreword to Bruce's book, there's a lovely foreword by Robert Sapolsky at Stanford. Mm-hmm. And he points to an irony that just as we begin to master the genome and potentially, get our hands on all the levers of life and biology, we learn that it's not just about how we manipulate chemistry or genes, that it's social status, it's lifestyle, it's social relationships. It's the way we live as much as our internal chemistry that we need to get a handle on.
I agree, and that's why there's no single pill for stress and why Dr. McEwen is correct when he says that it is a lifestyle-related process, this thing that we call stress, and it requires tremendous amount of personal effort in many ways to begin to work with these forces. I mean, I'm struck by the conversation that is currently going in terms of it's probably true that just having a job and having access to health care are not the maybe the singular variables in this case, but it does seem to me that there is a relationship between responsibility and control. So I think there's a good number of studies that would suggest that the higher level of your responsibility and the higher level your sense of control over your situation, the lower your perceived stress is.
Bruce McEwen, along those lines, I want to ask you, I guess, there's been talk about stress for a long time, and the kind of simple, straightforward solutions that you give, you know, eat right, exercise, sleep well, they seem so obvious. Given all the health issues that you see as tied to stress, and given how straightforward many of those answers are, why is it sociologically that we don't respond by taking up those solutions more effectively, more often?
Well, I think we all have to search our own souls and how difficult it is to change lifestyle sometimes and get a grip on things. It's not an easy matter. I mean, the whole history, for example, of a campaign against smoking is a good example, and now perhaps exercise, at least for the upper middle class, has sort of taken hold, but there are a lot of people who have not really bought into that message, and even if they have, who probably have a great deal of problems implementing it for themselves.
Saki Santarelli, Bruce McEwen's looking at it as an individual challenge, and clearly it is. On the other hand, you can almost look out at issues, for example, obesity in American society, and imagine a whole nation self-medicating with potato chips to reduce stress.
Yes. Well, I think it is an individual issue in many ways, and of course it has certainly larger social implications in terms of the quality of food that comes down through the food productivity system in the United States. I think the government has certainly taken some steps along the way in terms of Great American Smokeouts and Surgeon General's reports and things like that. But ultimately, it does wind up being an individual issue in many ways, and it winds up falling on individual people to actually ask themselves the question, what is actually driving me? What is actually motivating me? Where am I actually going? And what is the source of my dissatisfaction? Those wind up being the much more fundamental and deeper roots of stress. I think there are actually some very good early research suggesting that the kinds of lifestyle behaviors that we are all speaking of this evening can be developed. People can take those on, but there is a slow kind of dissolution of those changes over time in some people, and in other people, there doesn't seem to be a dissolution. And if there's any variable that seems to rise now to the top around what's the difference between these two sets of people, is that it has to do with one's perceived sense of self. It looks like the people that simply adapt those lifestyle changes but feel really like, I'm having to exercise, I'm having to not eat these kinds of foods.
I mean, they feel burdened by those.
Yes, in many ways it's still external versus the people who all of a sudden begin to say, this is just who I am.
This is who I am.
I eat, this is what I do, and that there seems to be a difference between those groups of people in terms of their perception of self. And that winds up, I think, being an important variable in all this, at least in the research we've been conducting in part at UMass and in other places as well, that one's orientation towards life and one's sense of how one sees oneself in the larger social fabric, as well as within the larger fabric of the world, if you will, in terms of things like meaning and purpose, wind up having tremendous implications in terms of how one handles these forces more effectively. And it has to do in many ways with people learning about the ways that they have, and we have all, been conditioned. And so we're largely on automatic pilot, and when a certain situation comes along, we simply react to that situation in a very kind of typical manner.
But not necessarily what you'd call the mindful manner. Here we go, as in so many things today, you start out talking about traffic jams and stress, and soon the thread is woven through to a sense of self and life philosophy. Bruce McHugh and Saki Santarelli, lots of people want to join us. I want to invite them in. Please stand by. Barrett's calling. Welcome, Barrett. You're on the air.
Hi, yes, thank you.
Sure.
My basic point is I think most Americans are kind of weak and soft. We create stress or we react to stresses when for the majority of the world and for obviously for most of history, we have a much easier life. And people want stress in their life or they're creating it.
So you're saying Americans are just a bunch of wusses and we should just suck it up?
Yeah. I think a perfect example is right now I'm baking my grandmother's Christmas cookie recipes.
Okay.
With a stand mixer and a food processor. And she did this 60 years ago every year, but not with all the
conveniences that you've got there.
Yeah.
Well, I wonder, Saki Santarelli, come in here. What about this sense that, you know, many people in the world today have a lot tougher lives than Americans do, and yet Americans are always complaining about their stress levels. Well, does that mean that they're wrong or that they're right in spite of all the conveniences somehow?
Well, I think it's neither wrong nor right. I think it has to do in large part with what was mentioned before. It has to do with psychological and emotional stress. And so it winds up having a lot to do with perception as well. So on one level, it may be that we could, in quotes, suck it up. And on another level, it may have to do with becoming more attentive and more aware of what are the choices I am making in my life? What am I actually putting my emphasis on, and why am I doing that? I mean, if we're attempting to climb a social ladder in a very particular way that is actually nearly out of our reach or maybe unhealthy, even if it is in our reach, then it's worth asking ourselves those kinds of questions. And quite frankly, often I think we don't.
Bruce McHugh, and this term suck it up comes out here, and you've written, however, that if we just kind of take on too much stress without keeping a good balance, that is precisely the way to health problems out of stress. But that was my sense anyway, that you're saying if you just tough it out and take on more and more stress.
Well, yeah, there's the John Henry syndrome, somebody taking on more and more to try to take on the burden of the world and finally suffering a heart attack or stroke. So there is, as Dr. Santarelli says, there is common sense is a very important element in this, and yet people do feel driven by their circumstances, by, you know, the family they're with and the situation in their life. They have something to prove. They have people they want to protect to try to do too much. I mean, that's one aspect of all of this. That's sort of the sucking up approach, perhaps, out of necessity. And I think Americans have proven themselves time and time again able to do that, even, you know, if perhaps when times are easier, we sort of slip into easier ways.
Well, Barrett says, people have had it tougher than us and have it tougher than us today. Deal with it. Barrett, thanks for your call. I want to welcome into our conversation Allison Mannheim. She's a stress reduction consultant. And Allison Mannheim, good evening, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Allison, tell us about the people that you deal with who come to you with stress issues. How do they know when it's time to stand up and go to someone to help them deal with those issues?
Well, some of the times people come to class, and they're just kind of interested. They find out about it through word of mouth, and they show up, and they're not quite sure why they're there other than they're interested. Then there are the people who really need to be there. And
how do they know that?
Generally, they tell me that there are physical problems. So physical problems might lead them to a yoga class or to a stress reduction class. I had a woman who came to a stress reduction session where we practiced gentle chair stretches and breath awareness. And afterwards, she told me that the session was really helpful because she held so much tension in her body, and she knew that she needed to be practicing something regularly, but she had no time to relax. It's what is going on, it's what's being said in the conversation, which is that people are just so busy, and that stress seems to mount and mount. So she asked me what she could do. She also had problems sleeping, too, and was self-employed, working at home out of a home office and worked late into the night. So I gave her two suggestions. One was about incorporating different practices into her day and trying to make that lifestyle change herself, practices like in her workday, sitting up straight in the chair with her legs uncrossed, taking time to stretch, moving around, doing chair stretches, taking breaks where she was just breathing, walks, and making time to sit and do nothing other than follow the breath going in and out, at least for 5 minutes a day, taking some time to do nothing. However, I know that it's very difficult to practice alone, and old habits die hard. Stress habits are very deeply ingrained.
Allison, I guess I want to ask you, because as we talked with Saki Santarelli and Bruce McEwen, we get right to these very enormous issues of stress as growing out of self-image, of social status, of life philosophy. Can we really combat those kind of factors with the way we sit and breathe?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I find that people are so busy they become disconnected from the fact they're breathing. They're disconnected from the present, and it's kind of like being on a hamster wheel of constantly going and feeling the need to do something. And if a person's not physically busy, then mentally they're thinking about the past or the future, but not being in the present. And a lot of what I teach are techniques that help people to wake up in the moment, acknowledge what's there without pushing it away or clinging to it, because from this place of awareness, it becomes possible to respond to life stressors and make skillful decisions. These are practices that aren't elusive. They're very practical and very portable.
So if someone is feeling stressed to such a degree that they're kind of hyperventilating as they drive home, how long does it take to turn that around if they begin practicing some of those habits?
Are you talking about actually being in the car and hyperventilating, or are you talking about putting a practice in place?
Well, I guess I'm just talking very generally about someone who's so stressed out that they just feel at their wit's end.
Right.
Are they months and months or years from getting to a better place, or can they, with some of these steps, turn it around in a matter of days, weeks? You tell me.
No, yeah. Definitely in days, or definitely in weeks, Tom.
Uh-huh.
This is Saki Santarelli, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
I mean, we have pretty good evidence. We've had 13,000 people participate and complete the stress reduction clinic at the university and at Massachusetts and at the medical school. And quite frankly, our clinic is in the form of a course. There are 200 clinics around the country using these methods now. Certainly people can turn these things around, but our clinic is in the form of a course that goes for 8 weeks. So we see people over the course of 8 weeks for about 30 hours over the course of those 8 weeks.
And there's a measurable difference.
Yeah, there's a measurable difference pre and post. We've published that research. We've published follow-up research 3 years out, 4 years out. And if people continue practicing the methods, they can continue to maintain the changes. I think what Allison was talking about in many ways is we're actually simply not teaching people to, in quotes, breathe their way through difficulties in their lives, although certainly the breath is a very portable and convenient method, because it tends to actually, we can only watch the breath and be aware of the breath in the present moment.
Saki Santarelli, hold that thought. We've got to take a break. Allison Manheim, thank you so much for joining us tonight. We're talking tonight about stress and human health. A little is good. A lot can kill you. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about stress and human health. Are we getting better as a society at handling stress? Does our society reward stress addicts? Can you relax and succeed? Or is relaxing, is mindfulness the path? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guests tonight are Dr. Bruce McEwen, author of The End of Stress as We Know It, and Dr. Saki Santarelli, author of Heal Thyself, Lessons in Mindfulness in Medicine. Right now, Nick's on the line. Welcome, Nick. You're on the air.
Well, thank you, Tom, for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I've been listening to the discussion, and I'm immediately reminded, and I wanted to mention, the experiment that I read about in psychobiology in college, namely that they kept putting more and more individual rats in a confined space, but with more than adequate food, more than adequate water, and their behavior, as the concentration and density increased, kept becoming more and more, I equated to stressful, more irrational and erratic, and I I think that's consistent with a much more autonomic sort of process, and I challenge the doctor in terms of, I think it's great to be able to come up with some management of symptoms, but shouldn't we really equate some of the principal causes of this stress, and maybe it is concentration of human beings constantly being forced to establish a pecking order or whatever.
Nick, hang on. Let's get a response from Bruce McEwen here. Please stand by. Bruce McEwen, how about it? Nick says, you know, let's not beat up on ourselves too much. We've got an environmental issue here. There's just such a crowd of humanity.
Well, I think, you know, Nick, I think you have a point. I think that's one aspect of a larger problem that we were already talking about, the pace of life. But, you know, we all, in principle at least, can make choices about where we live and what we do. That isn't always easy to exercise those choices. And I guess what we're saying is that if you understand what some of the factors are that may be causing problems that you have or you see around you that people have, I mean, we're citizens. We can participate in political process. We can help to determine how our society is organized. This isn't going to happen rapidly. And then we can also make the choices for our own individual lives as to how, whether we want to put up with a particular place to live or a job or something like that, and perhaps do something about it.
Nick, let me ask you about that. What do you think? Okay, we live on a crowded planet, and we live in an economy that demands a lot of hup-to, let's go. But does that mean, in your mind, that people can't or shouldn't take individual steps to try and address it?
No, I do think that we can probably address, in a mild way, the symptoms, but I think it's part of being human, and it's a very automatic process, and I was intrigued by all of the descriptions, you know, the cell phones, the computer, the constantly in touch. We really are never going to be able to eliminate that. The trend seems to be in the opposite direction, and I think we're going to have to recognize that stress may be an inherent part of being human in a concentrated city or a closer and closer proximity lifestyle.
I'm sure we all hear you, Nick. Thanks for your call. Bruce McEwen, you write about the kind of characteristics in particular individuals that help them be a little less vulnerable to stress. In fact, a lot less. You talk about people who have they have positive health, they handle stress, adversity, and aging well. Certain characteristics they have in common. One is self-acceptance. One is positive relations with others. There's this autonomy issue that you write about, the ability to regulate one's life according to personal standards, the ability to choose and create environments that are conducive to happiness, having a purpose in life, a strong sense of personal growth. That sounds like a package that most people will either have or not have. If you don't have that, it's tough to just walk out and develop it.
Well, I think this is where Dr. Santarelli's program fits in, trying to get people to discover this in themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what's so important about the sort of program that he's running, is that this gives a person a chance. I don't think it's I think people can acquire it. I'm sure he agrees. It may not be that easy, but I think people can acquire it.
And what about the impacts of childhood trauma on lifelong stress levels?
Well, that of course is something. It's almost sort of a hidden epidemic in our society that there is a lot of outright abuse of children in some, you know, segments of our society, and there is a certain amount of neglect as well. The simple lack of loving, supporting relationships for a child can be as devastating, perhaps even more devastating than having some abuse in a child's life, where in a case of abused child, there are often loving parents or guardians who are also providing love and support. All of these can leave scars that increase the risk for depressive illness, for other illnesses like post-traumatic stress disorder later in life, and
on the other hand, I was
affect physical symptoms like obesity and things of that sort.
But I was struck. You pointed out that in the research, rat pups, I guess baby rats, who were held and licked and the human equivalent of hugged by their parent rats a lot, turned out to be the most even keel rats as adults.
Yes, and on the same by in the opposite sense. Rats that were cared for by more nervous these less attentive mothers became more emotional and more reactive as they went through life. Now, if you think about that, the laid-back pup rat growing up is going to be fine in a safe environment where there's no threats.
Mm-hmm.
But if he's too laid back and goes out and gets eaten or attacked, that's not too good. So the more nervous disposition may be a better survival strategy for living in a more dangerous environment.
And if your research ultimately leads to a clearer understanding of the hormones that stress produces and perhaps chemical ways to respond to them, are we going to end up popping pills and cranking the entire level of social stress up to an even higher level, managing it through medication?
Well, I think actually no. And I think and I'll give you one good example. Recently, the National Institutes of Health ran a diabetes prevention trial in which they compared a promising anti-diabetic drug with a program of exercise, which was called extreme exercise intervention, but basically involved getting people who were fairly sedentary to about 30 minutes of walking a day. And they found that that was effective in about 60% in reducing the onset of type 2 diabetes, which is what's growing in our society now, whereas the medication was only about half as effective.
So it's not a pill, it's 30 minutes. Our time is running down, but Saki Santarelli, 20 seconds, last thoughts from you. Are we headed toward a more, I guess the word is, holistic understanding of health here around stress?
I think we are, and I think we're learning something about what we're really talking about acquiring is someone becoming more comfortable in their own skin, and I think that those are choices that people will make along the way. I think it's the striving for something that you may actually not even be comfortable with, but driven to because of inner or social forces around you that are in question, and that people can actually learn to begin to ask themselves those kinds of questions, as well as learning very practical, basic skills that will hold people in very good stead.
Let's hope we can. We're out of time. Dr. Saki Santarelli, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
And Dr. Bruce McEwen, author of The End of Stress as We Know It, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom, very much.
Good to have you. You can continue this conversation at our website, onpointradio.org. In a moment, remembering a punk rock legend, this is On Point. Joe Strummer, leader of the proto-punk band The Clash, died at his home in England yesterday. He was 50. With songs like London Calling and Rock the Casbah, The Clash transcended punk rock's individual defiance and rage with calls for political awareness and mass action. Like many young rockers growing up in the 1970s, writer Scott Haas was drawn to The Clash's merging of hard-driving punk rock with progressive lyrics. With the passing of Joe Strummer, Scott Haas recalls a time when he believed that rock and roll could change the world.
I start each morning by reading the headlines posted by the BBC over the internet. Korea is going to have nuclear weapons. UN monitors are interviewing Iraqi scientists. But what's this? Joe Strummer, former singer, guitarist, composer for The Clash, dead? At 50, apparently of a heart attack? No, can't be.
All across the town, all across the night, everybody's driving with full headlight. Black or white, you're turning on your face, a new religion. Everybody's sitting around watching television. Let's burn with boredom now.
In the early 80s, The Clash were the only band that mattered. I sought out messages in the music, suggestions on how to live my life, direction. No other group before The Clash had been so explicit about politics. This was the band that could change the world.
When they kick at your front door, how you gonna come? Put your hands on your head or on the trigger of your gun.
The Clash had a political sensibility inspired by what I took to be anti-imperialist, Afrocentric, neo-Marxist ideologies. Why, that's exactly how I saw the world, too. This band put the impending revolution to music. I still remember the chills down my spine when I first heard the song Police on My Back. God, how refreshing to hear that then. Every day I'd had some authority telling me what to do and when to do it, and here was The Clash saying, bugger off. You have to remember, these were the early years of the Reagan presidency. I was living in D.C. The right had ascended and was reveling in its triumph so smugly. There were secret dealings with Iran, attacks on affirmative action. The left was in total retreat, just like today. And who's going to show us the way out of this mess?
This is a public service announcement with guitar!
We had The Clash. Proud and fierce and unbowed, led by Joe Strummer, mad and vigorous, fearless.
You have the right to food, my man. Providing the doors, you don't mind a little investigation, humiliation. And if you cross your fingers, rehabilitation.
Over the summer of 1981, I traveled up and down the East Coast with my girlfriend to see The Clash perform at small clubs. The best concert I saw took place on the boardwalk in Asbury Park. I loved the militancy of the music, the urgency, the band's conviction, and to watch Strummer snarl and strut and then spit out the words of his music in that noisy, hot old ballroom, it was inspiring. It led me to believe in what I was doing. For a Jersey kid who saw Springsteen as the Tom Jones of rock and roll, I knew I'd found my way out. Nowadays, the heat of 20-plus years has cooled in my life, and I listen more to Ella Fitzgerald than to The Clash. I've got kids, a wife, I've even got a Volvo. That whole Marxism thing didn't quite work out the way I'd planned. But the BBC report said Strummer left a wife and children, so I guess it's okay to settle down, right? The sensibility The Clash brought to me through his music remains very much an incandescent part of my life. That passion matters, and the people in charge will say and do anything.
Scott Haas is a writer living in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Cassettes and CDs of On Point are available for $15. Go to onpointradio.org or call 1-800-909-9287.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Gregorian.